Welcome to Living the Dream Outdoors, the official podcast of Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. We live by the motto, it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. And we live the outdoor lifestyle every day. Whether you're a landowner or dreaming of joining the ranks of those closest to the earth, we're your brothers and sisters of the outdoors. We hunt, we fish, we're stewards of the land. And our Living the Dream team will show you the way to enjoying the land and all the outdoor pursuits it has to offer. Here's your host, Bill Cooper.
Welcome to the Living Dream Outdoors podcast. This is Justin Briel. I'm here with Bill Cooper and Dr. Michael Chamberlain from the University of Georgia. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing well. Doing well. How about you guys?
Hey, great. Anytime we're talking to a turkey biologist, yeah, we're happy.
Exactly. Talking turkey to anybody is fun. Yeah.
Hey, we've talked a lot of it this weekend, too.
We have. We've talked to quite a few different folks, different foresters, wildlife biologists that are through the NWTF in Illinois and Missouri. And now we get, I would say, probably one of the lead people that's studying the wild turkey.
Yeah, that's what they tell me. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Few accolades, huh?
Yeah. I've been blessed. I've worked really hard and have caught some breaks through my career. So,
well, man, I love to see people have success, particularly those people that work hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always a good thing.
In my household, if you didn't work hard, you were in trouble. So my parents were workers. And
boy, mine were too. My dad started me horn cotton when I was 6 years old.
Yeah.
Two hours, I was done.
Yeah.
I thought.
Yeah.
He called me back to school and kept me out there 10 hours.
Well, what is it they say about luck? It's where opportunity and, now I'm drawing a blank on it.
Yeah, something hit the road.
Yeah. Opportunity and preparation intersect.
Yeah.
I always thought it was opportunity and your daddy with a leather belt in his hand.
Yeah, that never hurt. That leather belt was a motivational factor. That's
for sure. Oh, man. You hit that nail on the head, but you're in the research end of things.
I am. Yep. I'm a researcher at the University of Georgia, and I've been conducting research on turkeys for about the last 31 years.
Wow, that's pretty incredible career. Now, have you been at the University of Georgia that whole time?
No, I started out, I went to graduate school at Mississippi State, and then I went to Louisiana State University, and I worked there as a researcher for about 11 years, and then I went to Georgia, where I've been ever since.
Quite the career. Quite the career. So what's, I mean, obviously, the things that we've been hearing about lately for the last few years have been the decline mm-hmm. in the population. Can you speak a little bit on what are you guys finding on that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've pretty clearly documented that populations, particularly in the southeast, started declining around the early 2000s. It's been a very slow decline from 1 year to the next. So when you look at the data from year one to year two, you didn't see any difference.
Right.
But when you saw year one to year 10 or year 15, you started seeing these dramatic declines in productivity, meaning we're not making the young birds that we did decades ago. And now if you kind of fast forward, the Midwest, parts of the upper Midwest are seeing some of these same declines, which if you look out in Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, in those areas, those agencies have documented pretty strong declines, and interestingly enough, and this is a positive, is that over the last 2 to 3 years, particularly the last 2 years, in parts of the South, it looks like our populations are doing a little bit better. We've seen a couple of years of decent reproduction, making a few more young turkeys now than we were, and that's encouraging.
You've
seen some states like Arkansas and Louisiana and Georgia that have made regulations changes to their spring season to make it more conservative, to give the birds a little more opportunity to breed and lower the bag limits. And in those states, you're starting to see a signal where population's starting to recover a little bit. And it gives me hope that we've been as low as we're going to go in some places, and now we can start seeing a little of an upswing, which is good.
Yeah, with any type of population or anything like that, there's so many variables go into it. There's not just one thing. If it was one thing, it'd be easy to fix,
right? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So it's, The biggest thing that when you guys are looking at that, it's like recruitment or poults per hen, is that one of the main factors you're kind of looking at as far as for your?
Yeah, we use poults per hen, which is just a number of young turkeys per adult, you know, older hens, mm-hmm. in the summer as a metric for reproduction. Of course, we use our field studies where we capture birds and we put GPS tags on them, and we can get really precise estimates of nesting rates and nest, you know, hatching rates, clutch sizes, poult survival, et cetera.
Right.
And so we kind of stick all of that together into a pot to make inferences about what the populations are doing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, listening to your work or other people that are doing these different studies and they're analyzing them, I always find it interesting. You guys might be looking at you're trying to do a study on, you know, poult recruitment or whatever, but kind of what spins off of that, you know, you notice different trends and different things.
Oh, for sure. That's science.
And then that spurs a whole nother train of thought of what about, you know, now we need to do a study on this to see how that affects things and the results. It's amazing. And then with the technology you guys have now, between the GPSs and the all the different stuff, it's really interesting from a layperson to hear about this.
Yeah, the volume of data we collect now, it's incomprehensible. I mean, when I was a graduate student at Mississippi State, I tracked birds, turkeys that were wearing, at the time they were very high frequency. You had to actually go out and listen to a beep.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get a couple of hundred locations on a bird throughout the spring, maybe 400 or 500. If you got to 1,000, that was a ton of data. We get 30 plus locations a day, 40, 50 locations a day, every 15 minutes all day.
Wow.
We get roost locations every night. So if a bird lives a year, we literally have thousands and thousands of locations. We can track everywhere the bird moves.
Wow.
And it's so to your point, when you start looking at those data, you generate a lot of other questions, because you may be interested in, okay, we're focused on looking at nest success. And then all of a sudden you start looking, I didn't even mention this, so we have accelerometers on the GPS unit. So when a bird gets killed, we can see when that happens. When she gets up and leaves the nest site, we can see that. And so you start spinning these other questions off, because you start looking at the data and realize, oh, wow, there's, like, for instance, half of the toms that are being killed by predators are being killed in the tree at night.
Owls.
Because you're seeing the signature in the data, and you start really, okay, well, what's happening here? Where are these toms getting killed? You know, are there particular roosts that they're dying at? And you just start, it almost becomes overwhelming. The point where you have more questions than you have answers.
It's what do they call that, analysis paralysis?
Where
there's so many different questions that you got to kind of funnel in on one, and this is where we're going to go.
You do, and when, you know, in my world, graduate students do the work,
right?
I just talk to people about it. So you get your graduate students and you tell them, I need you to focus on these three questions. Don't get off the rails here.
Right.
Go to these three points, and that's really hard. It's hard for them, because you wouldn't do what I do unless you were naturally inquisitive anyway.
Right.
And so you have and these young people that come through my lab that are graduate students and postdoctoral researchers, they're inquisitive. That's who they are. They want mm-hmm. to know answers to questions. And when you see so many questions and you can only answer four, it becomes a bit overwhelming at times.
I can imagine it's very frustrating.
It is. But thankfully, and there's, you know, there's double-edged swords to artificial intelligence and all these machine learning type tools and everything. But one benefit is that if you use them correctly, you can really speed things up in how you process these volumes of data that a human being couldn't possibly do.
Right, we're talking like numbers.
Yes.
It's analyzing numbers and doing that. And that's, you know, numbers don't lie.
Yep.
And that's, you know, maybe a number might be skewed here or there due to, you know, just whatever type of survey or however it was done. But if you take the average across, you know, and you guys are doing studies over huge areas. It's not like you're studying a little 40-acre piece.
Yeah, our study sites are usually 50,000 to 100-plus thousand, 150,000 acres. I mean, we're
right.
And usually we try to focus on public and private lands. So my work is paid for by state agencies largely.
Right.
And so hunters' dollars pay for my research.
Mm-hmm.
But and so we're often encouraged to start on public land, right? Wildlife management areas, national forests. But inevitably turkeys don't give a damn where the boundary is from
exactly.
Public to private. So our turkeys go on private lands, and that of course puts us on private landowners, you know, properties. We're asking for permission to access their property. We're giving them information.
Right.
We're bringing them into the work, and they, not all private landowners will welcome you with open arms, but 99% do, because they're interested in the bird themselves, particularly if they own recreational properties.
Oh, absolutely. And it's you. If you own the land, you're more connected to it and all the things that go along with that land.
Oh, for sure. Like you and I were talking about earlier today, is, you know, when you own land, you become, there's something changes about you. You may have been a steward before, but boy, you become really passionate about your property because you, there's such a sense of ownership and stewardship that goes in that property, that dirt that you own.
Right.
Yeah.
It's I experienced it, and it was more of a, I don't want to say giving back, because, I mean, it's not a selfless thing. Like, I want to have more turkeys, and I want to have that.
Yep.
But you can't just take and take and take and take and not help them out and then go, well, I wonder where all the birds went.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. Yep, that is for sure.
Well, I think there's been a learning process, though, because, you know, I watched the wild turkey and deer both come back in the state of Missouri, and it was an incredible process. But I can remember back there in the 80s, in the Missouri Ozarks, in the county that I primarily hunted in, it seemed like there was a turkey behind every tree,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Made me a really good turkey hunter.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But then when the numbers began to decline, I was like everybody else, I'm scratching my head, what happened, you know?
Yeah.
And it seemed like there's been such a surge in interest in, you know, the food plots and actually learning, the landowners learning,
yep,
how to be wildlife biologists.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of like everything else has become so instantaneous. We got those devices at our disposal, you know.
For, yeah, everything's at your fingertips.
You
yeah.
bet. I can look you up in a few seconds,
yeah,
you know, and
sure.
find out what's going on. So do you feel like in your career here, 30-plus years, that people have become, I don't know what term to use, I hate saying intelligent, I don't think people...
Educated.
Good yeah, good choice, I think.
I think what I see today compared to, say, 20 years ago is that, you know, for one thing, it requires a problem sometimes for people to become aware of something.
Exactly.
And when people became aware, they started seeing it with their own eyes, not just turkeys, but all of the challenges facing wildlife on our landscapes, habitat loss and urbanization and pieces of ground that you hunt that suddenly are a subdivision. And you know, and you see these things out your own window and you become concerned and you wonder what is this place going to look like 20 years or 50 years from now? And then you get to maybe the midpoint of your life and you get the opportunity to buy land. And you realize that your time on this earth is finite. And so you start really thinking about what can I do to make a difference on 40 acres or 10 acres, whatever it is. And I think part of it is just that. We've become more aware through time that the landscapes we live on have changed so much. If you're 50, I'm 53, and I can't even recognize places that I hunted when I was a young kid.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are gone. They're not even there anymore. It's a Best Buy, you know, a Walmart
right.
or whatever. And it really makes you think, you know, if I don't give back, if I don't do something, then all I've done is take, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what you see with a lot of people today. And then when they start giving back, they want to learn more and more and more about how to do better, how to be better, you know, how to manage property better. And the days of just, you know, walking out there and climbing up in a wooden deer stand that you tack nails up on, you know, on a tree like I did when I was a kid.
Yeah.
For in a lot of places, those days are gone, and I think there's certain benefits to that.
I completely agree. I think it's I what the biggest thing that I think is really neat about the information that you guys put out is it seems like there's a lot less of the coffee shop, the barroom banter, the old wives' tales as far as, you know, like one we always hear is that the turkeys killed all the quail.
Yeah.
And
I still hear it.
Oh, yeah. I do, too. And it's, there's been studies, and like you said, the technology is at your fingertips that you can go, well, according to these 17 studies, there's no evidence of that.
Yeah. Now, I still hear stuff like that, and it causes me, causes you pause because you're like, old habits die hard. I mean, that's just the way it is. But, and interestingly enough, and you know this, humans are humans, and you can show somebody information that's factually correct, and if they have a preconceived notion about what they think is the answer, that's the answer in a lot of cases. And and one thing that I think has helped us as a group, as hunters and managers over the last handful of years, is really traced back to COVID. One of the positive things that I think came out of that episode, that hellish thing we dealt with, was that we communicate differently now. Podcasts have exploded. Social media accounts have exploded. Your ability to get information and talk to each other has changed so much over the... And there's pros and cons to that, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think it's allowed us to be more aware of what's going on in other places, on our planet. And we realize that we're facing some of the same challenges that a guy in Missouri is facing or a guy in Idaho is facing or whatever. And we can tap into information, so much information now that we couldn't do, even 5 years ago.
Well, and like when you started in your career and you had mentioned you'd been in Georgia, Louisiana, and I know I'm missing a bunch of schools and places that you have been. Would they openly share information between different states? I was going to say that was helped. And has that changed?
Yes. Yeah, I talk about this quite a bit. When I was young, you didn't see situations where University A would collaborate with University B, and then University C would come in, and then they would just expand this big. I'm not going to say it never happened, but it was not common.
Right.
And as, mid-2000s, you started seeing some of these large cooperative projects on, like grouse, for instance, rough grouse, in response to population declines. And now it's very common to see, just earlier today, I'm in the hall talking with a colleague about setting up a study across three states, because we recognize that you're so much better if you're in partnership with somebody. And the agent, the data that we can give a state agency or federal agency, if we can give a data set based on 1,000 birds versus a data set from 100 birds,
right?
Well, no agency in their right mind would not want that better data set. So by collaborating, we can share resources, we can we become better because we get different perspectives about how things are working. The data, the way I look at the data may be very different from the way he looks at the data. And so these different perspectives really kind of help a better product.
Oh, absolutely. You get, like you said, different set of eyes on it. And they're going to look at a problem different than how person A versus person B. That's great to hear that. And you're getting a bigger sample size to where you're not just dealing with, these particular turkeys on this part of the world.
Yeah, we're combining data in some cases, 10 states,
right,
and thousands of birds. And when you get that much data, you start seeing the noise that's in the data, the variation that's in the data. That starts going away because you start getting closer to truth, if you will, the more data you collect.
Okay, we need to take a short break here, but folks, don't go away. We got a turkey researcher and two turkey hunters sitting here. You turkey hunt too?
Absolutely.
I've got three turkey hunters. So we got a lot to talk about yet. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Steve Stoltz with Drury Outdoors, and you're listening to Living the Dream Outdoors Podcast with Phil Cooper and Hunter Heineman.
Hey, this is John from CoAngler.com. Did you know that CoAngler.com is the newest online platform to connect anglers for fishing trips? You can create your free account, offer and request fishing trips, connect with anglers in your area, share some costs, share some knowledge, and share a great time in the outdoors. Whether you're fishing from a boat and you got an extra seat and want somebody to come with you, or you need some help shuttling those kayaks for your next float trip, CoAngler is a great way to connect with like-minded anglers in your area for a great time out on the water. So get on CoAngler.com and let's go fishing.
Hey there, listeners. At Conservation Federation of Missouri, we're more than just advocates for our environment. We're active in making a difference through hands-on programs that protect and preserve Missouri's natural resources. By becoming a member, you're supporting impactful initiatives like Share the Harvest, which provides venison to families in need, and Operation Game Thief, which helps combat poaching and protects our wildlife. You're also contributing to the RISPR grants, which fund local conservation projects across the state. Your membership makes these vital programs possible, ensuring that we continue to serve both our communities and our environment. Plus, as a member, you'll receive updates on these programs, invitations to exclusive events, and the opportunity to get involved in the work you care about most. Visit confedmo.org/join to learn more and to join us today. Together, we can support programs that protect Missouri's wildlife, waters, and way of life. Be a part of the Conservation Federation of Missouri, where action leads to conservation.
Hey everyone, this is Michael Collins with Misty Mountains Guiding Service. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what we offer. Misty Mountains is a smallmouth and trout-specific guiding service that caters to the Northern Ozarks region. My areas include the Upper Merrimack River, the Gasconade, and a few smaller creeks in the Mid-Missouri area. Whether you enjoy casting streamers to bass, drifting a dry fly, or ripping lips with spinning gear, I've got you covered. Fishing is made easy in my state-of-the-art drift boat raft. I control the boat with ease while you or yourself and a buddy do all the work at catching fish. Besides a great day on the water, I provide all needed gear, a delicious shore lunch, and as much fishing knowledge as you can carry with you on the way home. Spots for the 2024 season are going fast. Give me a call or text today to get your trip booked. My number is 573-823-9057. Find me on Facebook and Instagram at Misty Mountains Guiding Service. It's always an adventure with Misty Mountains.
Hey everybody, this is Alex Rutledge with American Roots Outdoors. Check out my buddy's podcast show, Living the Dream Outdoors with Bill Cooper and Hunter Hindman. You're really going to enjoy this week's show.
Welcome back to the Living the Dream Outdoors podcast. This is Justin Brill. I'm here with Bill Cooper and Dr. Mike Chamberlain, talking turkeys, turkey science. And for this segment, I'd kind of like, we just have some questions. And what's the biggest, in all the research and things, I'm sure sometimes you try to go into it with science without a preconceived notion, but
yep.
You always, I mean, you probably got an inkling of the way you think something's going to go or how to figure out. What are some of the big curveballs you've seen over your years of doing research?
Yeah, I think one of the big ones that really threw us for a loop was we see repeated examples of, you know, a tom roosting in the same tree several nights, and then all of a sudden he moves somewhere else and another tom comes in and roosts in the exact same spot.
Wow.
We see that very, very commonly, to the point where from any day one to day two, there's an equal probability that those are not the same toms in that tree.
So when you hear the guy, oh yeah, I set up on the bird and he went the other way, and then the next day him where he went the day before, there's a pretty good chance that those are two separate birds altogether.
Different birds that very likely have different strategies. You know, bird one flies down, he heads north because he thinks he's going to intercept some hens over here. Bird two, his strategy is he's going to fly down, go southwest to go. And so you and I come in there in the dark 2 days in a row and we get our tails kicked on day two and we're like, man, yeah. did he hear me? Did he see me?
Yeah.
No, very likely you just hunting two different turkeys. You
know? It makes me feel better about my calling.
Me too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Golly, how many times have I had that happen?
Oh, I've had it happen dozens and dozens of times.
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah. I used to think about it. In fact, it happened one time when I was a student years ago. And I remember thinking, in fact, I talked to my dad who was on the hunt with me. I said, I swear, we got back to the hotel late that afternoon. I said, I swear, if I didn't know better, I'd swear that was two different turkeys, because this, not only did he do the complete opposite of what we thought he was going to do, But his gobble, he didn't even gobble the exact same.
Right.
You know, it was a gobble, but it didn't have the same pitch. I swear that was two different turkeys. And I'm second guessing myself, of course.
Right.
It would very likely was two different birds.
Well, yeah, I mean, in your mind, it's the same spot.
Yet he was in the same tree.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'd be safe now to brag that I'm a much better turkey hunter than I thought I was?
Yeah, for sure.
Well,
yeah.
Honestly, from a hunting perspective, this has nothing – well, I wouldn't say nothing to do with the science, but it's – you know, you hear that, oh, that bird's call shy then.
Yeah.
Because, well, no, he's probably not. He's just doing something different, and he doesn't want to go that way.
Yeah, yeah. You were not in his agenda to begin with because he was doing something different.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you mentioned the predation. On wild turkeys, and you'd mentioned on the adults. That's we always think, you know, where I'm from in Illinois, we hear about coyotes, we hear about bobcats. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows about the nest predators, but there are some surprising things that you guys have found.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so these new GPS units that we use on the birds have triaxial accelerometers in them, like your Fitbit, right? Mm-hmm. So we can see very clearly when the bird gets killed. You can see the signature clearly on the data. So what we found is that a lot of birds are dying in the tree. They're being killed presumably by great horned owls, which are a primary predator of turkeys. And it's not just toms that are gobbling, which was, to be honest, that was my hypothesis. I thought what was happening was probably these owls were killing toms, which we've seen through the years. They were killing toms right at daylight, right when they were gobbling. And what we've recently discovered is that's not the case. They're killing them all night.
Wow.
So that tells me that these owls are actually going, and turkeys are part of their search image. That's a prey that they – it's not opportunistic. If they're hunting, and if they see turkeys, they're going to kill them no matter what time of day or night. In this case, they see them.
Yeah.
The other thing we're seeing, which is interesting, that we talked about briefly off the air, was for hens, we actually see that the window is from about the end of February to about the end of March is when a lot of hens are being killed in the tree. And that coincides with when horned owls are raising their young. They have young hatchlings. You know, we were talking about the woods are completely bare at that time. It's before leaf, you know, green up. And prey is limited. If you're something that eats mammals or, you know, man, that's a tough time of year to be a horned owl. And if you're trying to raise little ones, it's even tougher. So it makes sense that they're killing turkeys then. But that was a surprise to us that significant amount of predation is happening at night.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What about have you guys been able to break that down as, like, different stages of life for the turkey, you know, whether when it's a obviously eggs, you know, nest raiders, things like that, when they're a poult, kind of what's a top predator?
Man, for young poults, almost, I mean, you name it. Obviously, you know, the coyotes and cats and things like foxes that can kill younger birds like that. But we see rat snakes, coach whip snakes, if you're in the, you know, down in Texas, will chase down and kill poults, grab poults. So if you think, you know, birds of prey, mm-hmm. hawks, owls, anything that can take a young bird off the ground or out of a tree, you know, when they're roosting with mom, it's tough being a poult.
Yeah.
You know, for sure.
And isn't there's a substantial, the numbers go up quite a bit if once they can roost in a tree, correct?
Yes.
The survival rate is what I was thinking of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So once they can start roosting off the ground, which is about 2 weeks-ish, their survival skyrockets. It's not a guarantee they're going to live, but it gets much higher. And the reason for that is obvious if you think about it. When they're very young, they're roosting on the ground around mom at night. So anything that's on the ground can kill them easily. And versus when they're in a tree, you know, a lot of the culprits are just moving around under them, and they're protected. They're also flight capable at that point, so they can make short flights. So if something flushes them out of the tree, they can flutter to another branch.
Right.
So their survival goes up a lot.
So really, and I'm taking this down to the layman dumbest level I possibly can, from what I'm gathering is in order to have more turkeys, it's pretty basic. We got to more from egg to flying is what we really need to concentrate on.
Yeah.
And then the habit, what habitat they need for that.
Yes,
for to sure. get to that point.
Yeah, and what we see, what I see in my own travels, and I travel all over the country turkey hunting, is that there's nesting habitat everywhere. Turkeys will nest in a lot of different places and be successful. But what I see a critical lack of is brooding habitat. And brooding habitat is very specific. If you want to know what it looks like, get out on your belly and look out in front of you. That's what a poult sees when they're a week old. Mm-hmm. And so if you lay on your stomach and you can't see to move around, they can't either.
Right.
And so if you think about all the changes to our landscape through time, you know, I drive around the southeast now and I look out my window and I see a lot of thick, brushy, dense, not as open, pine-dominated habitats that may have been hardwood when I was a kid. And all those things result in plant communities that are more dense.
Right.
And that's not poult, that's not brooding habitat, unless it's managed.
Right.
And that's part of the reasons for the declines we've seen in reproduction. It's just a lack of management and a change in land use practices. And one of the big ones is hardwood loss.
Yeah.
We see unequivocally that broods go to hardwoods. If they're hatched in upland pine, she is going to move them to hardwoods. And it's not just a foraging thing. Hardwoods are cooler, right? They're cooler. Right. And you and I know this. You're out busting your can in the summer, and it's hot, and you're in an upland pine stand. You see a bottomland hardwood area over there with a stream running through it. You know you can go in there, and it's 7 or 8 degrees cooler, and you can cool off
Absolutely.
A little bit. Well, they do the same thing. So this significant loss of hardwoods we've seen across the South has been problematic, and that's linked partially to the declines we've seen.
I've noticed where I live, I'm in Illinois in farm country. It's a lot of ag, and people talked about it from the quail perspective, but it ties in, I think, directly with the turkeys as well. It's your brushy draws, your ditches. Those are all now planted in fescue.
Yeah,
are completely pushed out. And you were talking like you lay on your belly and you look through that. Fescue just forms a mat.
It's a dense mat forming grass.
And they can't get through it.
That's right.
And isn't there something with also thermal regulation where with the when they get wet from all the dew and stuff on it, that they can't thermoregulate,
right.
So they die of hypothermia.
Yeah, so basically if you're forcing a poult to move through dense grass that it's climbing through and over, early in the morning it's going to get soaking wet. Just like you and I, we go chasing after a bird, go across a clover patch that's, shin high. When you get to where he is, your feet are soaking wet.
Yep.
You don't care, but that's because you can control your body temperature. Well, that poult can't. So, yes, forcing them to move through these dense vegetative areas is problematic, for sure.
Wow. Interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I've learned a lot of new things here today. Either that or I've forgotten them.
Well, that's a sign of getting older. But, my dad used to always say, it beats the alternative. Getting older beats the alternative.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, absolutely. I'm 75 years old, but I guarantee you, if I make it to April, I'm going to be in a Ozark Ridge somewhere.
There you go.
Listening to the turkey gobble.
I feel confident you will be.
Oh, me too. I'm so looking forward to spring. Man, my bones kind of ache in the wintertime,
My bones don't ache much, but I'm sick of the cold. I'm sick of the dreary and the cloud.
He's from Georgia.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm tired of it. I'm ready to see a 70-degree spring day with a beautiful sun and hear that bird ripping his head off. Right around the corner.
Absolutely. Yep. I'm looking forward to that spring trifecta, I call it. That's crappie plays, turkey breast, and morel mushrooms.
Yeah. There you go.
But
it always comes back to food with you, Bill.
Well, that's what helps you survive. Same thing with turkeys, right?
Exactly.
I don't know if they like crappie fillets, but.
I love crappie fillets. I'll be honest with you. I used to fish a lot. I don't fish much in the spring anymore. All I do is work. Or hunt.
Right.
Yeah.
It
doesn't sound like a bad life.
I'm okay with that. Okay. I'm okay with that because from my perspective, I can come talk to people like you about turkey habitat or turkey whatever all day long. But if I don't go see it with my own eyes, then I don't have the credibility that I need. I need to see turkey habitat. I need to visit places where turkeys live. And if I do that, I can discuss it and be intelligent about it. Otherwise, I'm speaking out of turn.
Well, and I, like you were saying, see it with your own eyes. And you and I spoke about this earlier. You know, where I grew up and where I live, it's forester ag.
Yeah.
That's what it is. So, like, the idea when I started hearing people talk about woodlands, well, I just thought, well, yeah, it's the woods.
Yeah.
No, but it's totally different. It's more open canopy. Yep. You're getting sunlight. And the problem, and I'm sure it's, well, I know it's in the South and other parts of the world too, are invasive species, plant species.
Yep.
That are taking over. We have bush honeysuckle, Russian olive,
yes,
Lespedeezus,
yes.
And it's yes. completely wipes out, well, I shouldn't say wipe them out. It's not like it kills them, but they can't, it blocks it out. It's a lower closed canopy.
Yep, yep. So something I see that really causes me pause is in my part of the world, Japanese stilt grass is a common invasive species. You see it really, it takes over hardwood bottoms, just completely takes it over. And we actually, when we go to the places our broods visit, it's Japanese stilt grass in a lot of cases. And when you start digging around in stilt grass and looking, you don't see a lot of insects.
Right.
So if a brood hen is thinking, this is the best spot I have available to me for my brood, that causes me concern.
Well, and they're not going there because they like it. They're going there because it's the only available
exactly.
option.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, I may not love McDonald's cheeseburgers, but if it's the only thing around there,
yep.
I'll eat them.
Yeah, and it gets me thinking, like, so in these, we know that these broods are going to go to hardwoods. We know that. Well, if they get to those hardwoods and it's all Japanese stilt grass, then is she going to leave? Well, no, she's probably going to make it work. But
Wow. Does
it take those poults? If there are fewer insects there, but that's the cooler microclimate, that's where they need to stay, does it take them longer to fill up each day? Does that cause them to not gain weight as fast? Does it cause them not to be able to gain flight feathers? So maybe instead of flying into a tree at day 14, it's day 17 or day 18.
And that's critical
and
to get them in the tree.
All that matters. And it makes me wonder whether some of what we've seen with these declines are these little subtle things
right.
that are not obvious to you. When, you know, it's not the smoking gun. It's like, well, if it is taking poults a couple extra days longer to get those flight feathers in their wing where they can hop off the ground, well, then that's three or four more days he or she has to sleep on the ground.
Right.
And that's bad, right?
Right. We had just talked about that. That's critical. That their chance of survival goes through the roof once they get on a limb.
Yeah, yeah. So if it takes a few extra days, that may not seem like a big deal, but if that results in – you know, a 10% increase in poult mortality compared to not.
Right.
Well, over 20 years, that matters.
Oh, yeah. You yeah. compound it.
Yeah.
You compound it.
That's right. That's right.
Wow. Well, Dr. Chamberlain, you've answered a ton of questions today, but one last one. Now, you do have a crystal ball, right?
I will try. Let me rub it and take a look at it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, give us as best you can a prediction of what you think we can expect in the United States as far as the turkey population in the next decade or two.
I think probably, like we've talked about, I think probably you're going to see that, I hope, that populations have gotten about as low as they're going to get in some areas and are now starting to recover a little bit. You know, with turkeys, and you guys know this, they're, if we catch a couple of good years of nesting and brood, you know, production, man, you can go from a hobo to a hero in a couple of years.
Right.
It's whether we can sustain that through time. And that's what I hope, what my crystal ball says is that we're heading now in the right direction in a lot of areas. Not everywhere.
Yeah.
We've got some real challenges that face this bird over the next few decades and on. And those challenges are not going away, and they are significant. Habitat loss, us, our population growth, and our demand for dirt to produce food. I mean, there are things that aren't going away. But my crystal ball says if we maintain our awareness and our passion for this bird and we're willing to work together to see sustainability and stewardship of the turkey populations, then we're going to be in good shape down the road.
Well, boy, that's encouraging news for sure. Now, you're obviously a very knowledgeable. You spent a lot of your life studying turkeys. If people want to follow you or see what you're doing, how would they go about it?
Yep. So you can go to wildturkeylab.com. That's the website that I maintain. I saw I saw my wife and my web developer walk by a few minutes ago, so there he's in the house. We put all kinds of content on that website, and we're actually going to put a ton of content this spring on wildturkeylab.com. Short little informational reels about to show people what does brood habitat in Missouri look like? What does it look like in Kentucky? What is it, you know? So we'll awesome. Be putting a lot of that out there. If you're on social media, on Instagram and Twitter, my handle's at Wild Turkey Doc, one word, Wild Turkey DOC. If you're on Facebook, just type in my name, Michael Chamberlain, and you'll immediately see. I think I should be first in the search engine, and you can follow me on those. I post every week content on a post I call Turkey Tuesday that I've been doing for a number of years, and I post quite a bit on all of that. If you ever want to contact me and you can't get through social media, because as you can imagine, messages kind of build up.
Yeah.
If you just go to the University of Georgia's homepage, uga.edu, and just type in my name, you'll see an email address, and I respond to every email I get. So
wow, that's pretty incredible.
For the folks listening in Missouri, I know that the NWTF Missouri chapter also posts, they share all of your Turkey Tuesday stuff. That
I
you
see
put
that,
out.
Yeah.
So,
yep. Yep.
So that's another way it's out there that can be a convenient. Anymore, if you can't find information on it, you're not looking very hard.
Yeah. And I'm fortunate a lot of people do share. I mean, I've got friends, and Billy Yargis lives in Missouri, yep. And he shares my post all the time. And it's very humbling for people to have enough, I guess, confidence in me and what information I'm putting out there to be willing to share it with people. Because you can share crappy information just as well as you can share solid information.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that
is the negative part of it. It's great everybody has a voice, just not everybody's got a great voice. They can put it out there. There could be some bad information out there.
Well Dr. Chamberlain, I'm going to make a prediction, too.
Okay.
Coming this spring, there's going to be more than two smarter turkey hunters thanks to your work. Because I know the two of us are going to get on it.
Well, yes. If anybody's interested in what I do, if you gain one little nugget that helps you be a better turkey hunter or a better steward, then it's worth my time.
Yes, sir.
I appreciate that attitude. Appreciate you being on the program.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Hey, we are Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast, and all three of us sitting here, we're living our outdoor dreams.
We are.
We have for decades. We encourage our listeners, guys, get out and enjoy your outdoor dreams as well. I'm Bill Cooper.
Captain Brian Wilson runs one of the tightest bow fishing operations in the business. Stainwater Bow Fishing operates out of Jerome, Missouri, and the beautiful Missouri Ozarks. They cover most Ozark streams and lakes. You haven't lived until you've searched Ozark waters during the night with Stainwater Bow Fishing while looking for giant gar, carp, and buffalo. Captain Wilson also runs a second boat on Taneycomo Lake. Call today to book a trip with Stainwater Bow Fishing at 573-263-8016. Again, that's 573-263-8016. Be sure and shoot straight.
The Living the Dream Outdoors podcast is brought to you by Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, the Fly Rod Journals, SmokerBuilder.com, Cowtown USA, Westover Farms, Scenic Rivers Taxidermy, Stained Water Bow Fishing, Scenic Rivers Guide Service and Tours, Huzzah Valley Resort, Pico Lures, Devil's Backbone Outfitters, The Fallen Outdoors, Ledco Sinkers and Lure Company, Turnbow Outdoors, J&J Charters, Kaufman Cove, Alaska, Big Ed's Guide Service, Bean Creek Game Calls, Misty Mountain Guide Service, ASO Guides and Outfitters with Ryan Walker, On the Hook TV, Expedition Trailers, The Rambling Angler, Spare Rib Inn in Steelville, Missouri, and Rich's Famous Burgers.
Land ownership is the American dream. Land is the basis of all life. Our wise use of this most precious of resources ensures the survival and growth of free institutions and our American way of life. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we value the traditions and freedoms that land provides us. Every day we seek the solace of a mountain sunrise over traffic jams and smog, the calming silence of a bubbling stream over the sirens of the city, and the quiet of the countryside over the hustle and bustle of the world. We hunt, we fish, we farm. We live off the land. It's our mission to help our clients live out their dreams on the land as we do. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we believe that it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. Join us 5 days a week on Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast as the Living the Dream Outdoor Dream Team explores the most desired outdoor properties in the Midwest and whisks you away to incredible hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation opportunities. Host Bill Cooper, an inductee of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, will be joined by members of the Living the Dream Outdoors team each week as they tell tall tales, unveil tips and tactics, and rub elbows with some of the biggest names in the outdoor world. You'll also find the Living the Dream Outdoors podcast on your favorite social media platforms, including Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok.